So hi everyone, this is Abhishek Maniar, postdoc at the Center for Cosmology and Particle Physics of New York University. And so yes, as Neil mentioned, I'll be talking to you about a couple of results we had this year, and if time permits, also something new I've been working on about very recently. So these two results I'll mainly be talking about relate to the field of weak lensing. In one case, I'll talk about only the CMB weak lensing, but in the other one, along with the CMB weak lensing, I'll talk about some other probes and applications of this weak lensing technique. And yeah, I have never been to the perimeter, never been to Canada, in fact. So I hope next time I'm giving a talk or something, I'll be in person. And yeah, feel free to interrupt me or ask me any questions if something is not clear, if I'm going too fast or something. All right, so let's get to it. The first paper, result I'll be talking to you about is some a globally optimal estimator which we proposed for the CMB weak lensing. And this work was carried out in collaboration with Yasin Ali Haimood, Gillian Caron, Anthony Lewis, and Matt Mather-Sherrill, who is at perimeter. So weak lensing of the CMB, this will keep coming up a lot of times in the talk, so I better make sure everybody's on the same page. So what happens when we say that CMB, the cosmic microwave background, has undergone weak lensing? So there is a distribution of a lot of dark matter and visible matter in between us and the last scattering surface from where the CMB originates. And this, on their way towards us, the CMB photons get deflected due to this foreground matter fluctuations. So what we actually observe as the CMB map is a distorted CMB map. And this is nothing but the weak lensing of the CMB. And so as I said, this is what we observe is just a distorted map, which you can see here, there is a lensed and unlensed map. So lensed map is nothing but unlensed map in a given direction, just with a slight deflection, where the deflection is related to something called lensing potential. And this reconstruction of this lensing potential is one of the major goals of the upcoming cosmological experiments. And why is that? Because this lensing potential is giving you a picture of the projected mass distribution in a given line of sight. So it basically gives you the, if you reconstruct this phi in several directions, it basically gives you a projected map of the whole matter in the universe along those directions. So that is something really cool. And in this talk, sometimes I'll use the lensing potential or something called kappa interchangeably, but they are related to each other. So yes, so as I said, the lensing potential or kappa, it probes the projected mass density. In case of CMB lensing, what this means is it probes the whole projected the whole matter between this last scattering surface and us here. We are at here redshift zero. And this is the typical shape of the lensing kernel for the CMB. And as you can see, it goes from redshift zero to all the way to 1000, where this last scattering surface is there. And as I said, because it probes the whole matter field, although in a projected form, it's reconstructing this is a major goal, because then you get a direct picture of the matter field at all the redshifts. And can this be done? Yes. So I find this map very fascinating. This is a reconstructed lensing map from the Planck satellite. And I think this map is really cool because it basically gives you a picture of the whole all the matter in the universe projected on this surface on our screens. And so something like this is possible. And how do we do this? This is where the concept of quadratic estimators comes into picture. So we use something called quadratic estimators to calculate this lensing potential. How do we do that? What does it mean to have a quadratic estimator of CMB lensing? So just imagine a universe where there is no lensing, And then what I do is when I observe the CFB in temperature or E and B mode polarization, if in the absence of lensing, if I cross correlate two different multipoles of any of these maps, TEB, then what I get in return is I recover the power spectrum. Basically what that means is different multipoles are uncorrelated. Now, if I introduce lensing, what happens is apart from this power spectrum term, we have this extra term where you will see some factor of F times this phi of L, which where phi is basically the lensing potential, which we are trying to measure. Now, again, here X and X prime can be anything, TE or B mode polarization. And this F factor, as you can see, depends on these different multipoles we are correlating. So what this means here is what lensing has done now is it has introduced some correlations between different multipoles, which were uncorrelated in the absence of lensing. So that's what basically lensing does. And now how do we reconstruct this phi from these correlations? So if you look at this equation carefully, you will observe one thing that if you take this F of alpha on the left-hand side, what you are left with is only phi of L here. So what you do is you take pairs of multipoles and then you give them some weight for these pairs of multipoles, which is when you take this on the left-hand side, and then you sum over different many such pairs to get an estimate of phi of L. And because we are using pairs of multipoles, that's why it's called a quadratic estimator. That's the basic principle behind quadratic estimators. So basically phi of L is some weight times a pair of multipoles, and you do this weighing and multiplying the different multipoles for several pairs of L and L prime, and you recover phi of L. Of course, you recover it with some reconstruction noise. So this is the basic concept behind the quadratic estimators for the CNB lensing. Now, there are several quadratic estimators, broadly speaking, of the CMB weak lensing in practice. And here I divide them in four broader categories. The classic Kuo-Nakamoto estimator, which was the first proposed CMB weak lensing estimator. Then something called Okamoto and Hu. Then the estimator which we propose here, global minimum variance estimator, GMV. And something called suboptimal quadratic estimator, SQE, which has been used in the final data analysis of SPTE and Planck data. Now, for now, I plan to only speak about these three estimators, Kuo-Nakamoto, GMV, and SQE estimator. If time permits, I'll briefly mention what Okamoto and Hu estimator is. But I'll nonetheless try to talk about these three estimators in detail. So let's get started with the Kuo-Nakamoto estimator. Kuo-Nakamoto estimator has a very simple form. Basically, as I had said before, you take some weights for a pair of multipoles and you sum over different pairs of these several such pairs. Now, what Kuo-Nakamoto do is they construct five minimum variance estimators with this construction, where these five estimators are TT, EE, TE, TB, and EB. Now, as I said, these are five minimum variance estimators. So when I say they are minimum variance, what that means is, for example, when I do phi TT, this FTT is determined such that the variance of this equation is minimized. Similarly, FEE is determined such that variance of this whole equation is minimized. And then once you have these five minimum variance estimators, in the second step, what Kuo-Nakamoto do is they combine these estimators with a linear combination such that these weights are determined through inverse variance technique. So the final aim is this final estimator has the minimum variance. It's the minimum variance linear combination of these individual minimum variance estimators. So that hope that makes sense. So basically, once again, repeating, they estimate five different estimators, which are minimum variance in themselves, and then they combine them to form the real minimum variance, their final minimum variance estimator. Now, does this work? Absolutely, it does. So this is, I'm showing you a result of Lenzing reconstruction with this Hu Onokomoto estimator for a Simons observatory-like experiment. Now, what I'm showing you here is in the red curve is the Lenzing power spectrum. That is the signal we are after. The CLDD, CL kappa kappa, that's what we are trying to measure. And in different colored curves, what you have is the reconstruction noise coming from different estimators, these five estimators, TT, EE, TE, TB, EB. And then in black curve, you have the their minimum variance combination. So this is the final minimum variance combination coming out of the combination of all these curves. And how do we read this plot? Basically, what this means is, let's say at L of 100, our signal is of the order of 10 to the power minus 7. And if I talk about, let's say we take the TT, which is the violet violet curve here, at L of 100, it is of the order of few times 10 to the power minus 8. So what that means is just using the TT map, I can measure this signal at L of 100, which is of the order of 10 to the power minus 7, with the error bars of few 10 to the power minus 8. That's what this plot means. And then, of course, you can see the minimum variance is smaller than all the noise on the minimum variance estimator is smaller than all the individual estimators. And I make a comment here that even for a Simons observatory-like experiment, the data is still going to be temperature dominated. What I mean by that is the minimum variance curve is going to have maximum contribution from the TT pair compared to the other polarization data. So that's why I say it's temperature dominated, which won't be the case for CMBS4-like experiments. Okay, so that's the Hu Onokomoto estimator. And as I promised to you, I'll talk to you about the GMV estimator next, which is what we propose in our paper, which is the global minimum variance estimator. So what's the difference between GMV and Hu Onokomoto estimator? So Hu Onokomoto consider the correlations between different XY estimators after they integrate over L1 and L2. So they do this in two steps, first individual estimators and then their correlations. So what we realized that actually it would be more optimal to account for these correlations at each multipole level and then directly integrating over them. So, and then we realized this has to be less noisy than Hu Onokomoto. And this is the best we should be able to do in terms of quadratic estimators. So that's the basic difference. So the final estimator, the GMV estimator, looks something like this. So it's a very subtle difference, but this difference, as I'll show you, matters. And this is how the estimator looks like. And in this case now, FTT, FEE, they are determined such that this whole equation has minimum variance, rather than FTT just minimizing the TT part, FEE just minimizing the EE part. So that's a subtle difference, but it's a difference nonetheless. So once again, in more compact mathematical form, how does it look like? So Hu Onokomoto, basically, they have in these individual estimators where these weights look like this, where you have individual pair, you just have their power spectra. But for GMV estimator, since we do everything in one step, now instead of dealing with these single numbers vectors, what we have is matrices now, this CL matrix and this sigma matrix. Now, one of the things you will see here, which I won't talk in detail about, is if you observe the GMV form, you'll see that it's separable in L1 and L2, this estimator. And what that allows us is to calculate this very quickly using fast Fourier transforms. Otherwise, this process is kind of slow. So this is one of the advantages, that it's separable in L1 and L2. And so it's fast to calculate. So we were really excited initially about this. But later on, we realized that this estimator was actually previously derived, but it was actually thought that this is GMV is actually Hu Onokomoto estimator. That's how it was written. That's why it was understood all this time that there is no difference between these two estimators. But as I'll show you in this slide, that is not the case. So again, what on the left hand side, what I'm showing you is for a Simons observatory like experiment, the noise curves for Hua Nakamoto and GMV estimator. So in blue, we have the noise coming from the Hua Nakamoto like estimator, and the red curve is the same curve for GMV estimator. And as you can see, the red curve is below the blue curve at all the multipoles. And on the right hand side, I show the difference between them. It's, and as you can see, the GMV estimator is of the order of 8 to 10% smaller in terms of noise than the Hua Nakamoto estimator. So what's happening here is we are basically extracting more information out of a given map, you know, just by using the data more optimally, let's say. So this was is there a question?
Hi, Abhishek.
Hey, so
yeah, so I have a question regarding this estimator. So there is also a second order contribution which comes from the phi squared term.
Right.
So are you neglecting that right now?
So on the first, all the results I have shown you right now, that's they don't include the phi squared contribution, like the higher order N1 biases. But I have a slide, I can show it to you later on, where you see that even for such biases, GMV performs much better than the other estimators, like
I
the Hua Nakamoto.
That's what I was about to ask. Thank you.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. So at the basic level, what is done in lensing reconstruction procedure is you perform this N0. What all the analysis I've shown you is something called N0 level analysis, where the power of N represents the power of phi you have in your noise sources or bias sources. And then there is something called N1 and N2 level biases, which are higher order biases. They are smaller than N0 biases, but they at some point you need to consider them for more optimal data, let's say. And we do consider them in the, we do show them that they are small as well with this estimator. But I'll show that slide later on. All right, so yes, so that's the GMV estimator. And then I said I'll also talk to you about the SQE, suboptimal quadratic estimator, which we call here, which has been used in the data analysis of Planck and SPT data. So suboptimal quadratic estimator is actually quite similar to INFORM to the GMV estimator, which looks like this here. And there is just one subtle difference here. In what suboptimal quadratic estimator does is in this sigma matrix, where you have these covariance terms of this 3x3 matrix of combinations of power spectra of T, E, and B maps and their correlations. What they do is they put CLTE is equal to zero. Why do they do that? Because this allows, so for example, if you have different masks in temperature and polarization, so you have like different cut sky setup in these two different maps. In such cases, it allows you, assuming CLT is equal to zero, allows you to lower the computational cost of your calculation and speeds up the calculation. And nonetheless, it also preserves the separability in L1 and L2. So it's again much faster. And of course, this has to come at a penalty. And for Planck-like experiment, they found that the penalties of the order of 3%. We found that the penalties of the order of 3%. So it's not, excuse me, it's not really big. But then we also found out that this estimator is actually suboptimal to Hua Nakamoto estimator as well. And that brings me to the final plot of this part of the talk, where I'm showing you a comparison between different estimators, which I talked to you about today, the GMV, SQE, and Hua Nakamoto estimators. Now, in this plot, all the dashed curves are showing you the ratio of the reconstruction noise coming from a Hua Nakamoto estimator with the suboptimal quadratic estimator. And different colors basically represent different experiments, like a Planck-like experiments is in blue color, then there is Simons Observatory-like experiments in red, and CMBS4-like experiment in green color. So let's focus on the dashed curves first. As I said, we found out that the SQ estimator is suboptimal to Huon Okamoto estimator as well. Then, now, if we focus on the solid curves, which is our main result here, that solid curve shows the ratio of the reconstruction noise from the global minimum variance estimator to the suboptimal quadratic estimator. So the ratio of their noises. And as you can see, for Planck-like experiment, this ratio is of the order of 3 to 6%, as I had said already. But for a Simons Observatory-like experiment, which is here in the red curve, this effect can be of the order of 11 to 12%, which is quite significant. And this brings us to our conclusion of this part of the talk, that this kind of penalty should motivate us to use the full covariance matrix rather than just setting CLT is equal to zero. So we can go to that extra pain of having some computationally difficult things to calculate, but we will gain this 11 to 12% in the reconstruction noise using the GMB estimator. So the conclusions from this part of the talk are basically Huon Okamoto procedure does not lead to the absolute minimum variance quadratic estimator, but the GMV estimator does exactly that. And they are not the same as was thought before. All the arguments I presented here today were for the flat sky setup, but these are equally applicable to the full sky setup. And where would we benefit out of such estimators are several applications. So as probably some of you know, that cross correlation of lensing is a really significant tool to constrain several parameters in cosmology. And for such cross correlation studies, having a smaller reconstruction noise on lensing will definitely increase the signal to noise on such parameters. Then there is something called delensing, which is happening in the CMB field, where we know that some of the B modes are created by lensing of the E modes. And then we try to delens those modes to get the pure gravitational B modes. And this is the delensing procedure. And in such cases also, we will benefit from using a GMV-like estimator because it has a smaller reconstruction noise for every step of this delensing procedure. So these are the places where we will benefit from this. So if there are no questions about this part of the talk, so feel free to interrupt me if you have some questions. Otherwise, I will go forward.
Well, so Matt has a question, but also I had a question as well. Matt, sure. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks, Neil. Hi, Abhishek. So on the plot that you showed comparing all the different estimators, does this account for sky cuts, or this is like full sky?
Right. So this is for now. I have assumed full skies for this. But if what you will see that because these are the ratios, it does not matter if I'm doing the full sky or 40% of the sky or 30% of the sky.
But okay, maybe let me. So assuming that they're just ratios is assuming you use the same cut for T and E and B.
Right.
So, but that won't be true.
Right, but that's absolutely right. But in that case, if you see in the actual, so let me go back to this slide. The main concern here is inverting this matrix, where you have different, because the sky setup is different. So for an SQE like estimator, this matrix is not that sparse anymore, and then it becomes difficult to invert it. But it is actually possible to construct a mask. So I have not done that analysis in this paper, but it is actually possible to make masks compatible for both the maps at the same time, which like a common mask for both the maps with very minimum noise penalty coming with that. Because what that means is in polarization, you probably have smaller foregrounds, for example, compared to the temperature. And what that means is you pay a slight penalty on the temperature side. But given such, if you have such masks, then again you can apply the same technique like this, taking the ratio and showing that the result is going to be of the order of 11 to 12%. But nonetheless, I think that probably won't be the main concern, because the difference between the sky coverage is not that big between temperature and polarization. Because even though in temperature the foregrounds are quite large than in polarization, because of the multi-frequency knowledge of the foregrounds, we can still reduce them to a great extent. And that's why, in fact, I didn't go in the details of what I mean by Planck-like or Simons observatory-like experiments. But what we do is we consider the multipoles only up to a level where we are confident that foregrounds won't be a problem.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that depends a bit on your goal. If we always just kind of throw away the lowest L in the lensing maps, I guess you probably don't care about saving a few percent of the sky. You know, yeah, if you wanted to dig there, then maybe it matters a bit more. And then my other question was, I just wanted to understand the difference between the SQE and GMV. The only difference is that in this matrix, you don't include TE?
Yes, that's the only
for
difference,
SQE?
That CLT is equal to zero.
Okay.
Basically, this matrix looks like, it actually looks like CLTT, CL, so the 0, 0 element, 1, 1 element in CLTT, 2, 2 element is CLEE, and then you have, sorry, CLTE and then CLEE and their correlations. So, and of course there is the B mode component as well. And then what you do is you just put CLT is equal to zero for SQE. That's the only difference.
Okay. Okay. Thanks very much.
There was another question.
Oh yeah. As my question was actually pretty basic. I was just wondering, is there some limit in which this Fukunomoto estimator is equivalent to, your global minimum variance estimator? We wanted to derive their estimator from yours. Would we have to assume that certain covariances vanish?
Oh, going from GMV to an Okamoto-like
experience. Yeah. What's the assumption, I guess, to go from yours to theirs, I guess?
Right. So, I think there should be a way to go from one to another, but it's not very obvious to me, because the thing is, the what they do in two steps, we combine it in a single step.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure if these things are separable in that sense, because we do consider these correlations at individual multiple levels. Because what happens is when they integrate over these multiples, I think some information is lost, and after that you correlate with other estimators. But that the lost information is recovered when you don't integrate over the multiples and you first correlate them and then integrate. But I'm not sure how, but I guess there should be a way, but I'm actually not sure. Okay. I cannot give you an answer on this.
Okay, yeah, that's no problem. I was just wondering. And also Shubhadeep has his hand raised. Okay, so go ahead, Shubhadeep.
Yeah, thanks. So I have a question regarding the T contribution. So if you have contributions from like T to E leakage, T to temperature to polarization leakage, then how much your estimators will be affected by that? Because then you'll be have some additional noise. Or did you include that as well?
No. So we have not considered the computational aspects like T to E leakage, because I think those even for an SQE-like estimator, even though you put CLT is equal to zero in this covariance matrix, you still need to consider them, for example, in this F matrix, or when you actually have the full calculation of the higher order terms. So I'm not sure how it is how this leakage is considered in the actual data analysis, but whatever the techniques they use in the actual data analysis could be equally used in this estimator as well. But you're right. I think such leakage will only add a certain noise. I think it won't add any bias because it won't be correlated with the other sources. So it would probably add some noise, but I guess I know that through simulations there are ways to check this leakage, and based on what I know for Simon's observatory like experiments where the polarization data is becoming more and more sensitive slowly, there are simulations to check that this leakage is under control, that it does not significantly alter the noise.
I see.
Yeah.
So because I was wondering that if TE correlation you are including, then some of the information which are there is cosmological information can be shadowed by this leakage.
Right.
Nice. So
very, very true. Yeah. I don't have a numerical answer to that. But I can only say that I think whatever the analysis happens in for real CMB maps or simulated maps, it's equally applicable here, whatever the techniques we use to reduce the leakage.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, sorry about that. So if there is no other question, I'm gonna go to the next part of my talk, but please feel free to, if you have some question again about this part of the talk, we can surely discuss it. Please feel free to interrupt. Okay, so the second paper is about a new probe of the higher redshift universe, nulling CMB lensing with interloper-free limpair lensing. First of all, I apologize for the really longish looking title. And this work is carried out in collaboration with Emmanuel Shan at Berkeley and Anthony Pullen at NYU. So I apologize for the longish looking talk, but I promise you that I'll simplify things by splitting this into major parts, like the higher redshift universe and interloper-free limb pair lensing. Now, this word limb will come up a lot in this talk. So I just want to clarify what limb is. Limb is basically the line intensity mapping. And again, I'm not sure how much people are familiar with this talk. So just to be sure everyone is on the same page, line intensity mapping basically measures aggregate intensity in 2D pixels, but at different frequency bins. So not only you have this 2D information, but because you have multiple frequency bins, you also have the redshift information. Very quick introduction from these plots. On the left-hand side, what you see is the gray dots are the faint galaxies, and the bright dots the red bright dots are the bright galaxies. Now, with a normal telescope from galaxy surveys, what you can do is you can increase your integration time, observation time, and you will detect these bright dots. But you will still miss out on really faint galaxies. Now, this is what line intensity mapping takes into account. It does not care if we detect individual galaxies by themselves. What it wants to do is it wants to measure this aggregate intensity, which for this field is shown here in this line in a corresponding line intensity map. So as you can see, for example, here, these faint galaxies were not detectable with the galaxy surveys beforehand, but now you can see their aggregate emission. So, and that's basically the concept behind line intensity mapping. So, and because I said that it does not care for the to detect individual sources, this technique is much more cheap than in terms of money and also in terms of time than the actual galaxy surveys. And because we have different frequency information, it has emerged as a probe of higher redshift universe, this line intensity mapping. So, but this line intensity mapping technique it comes with its own problems like interlopers and continuum. So what we are trying to measure is emission from a specific atomic or molecular lines. So in that we have different galaxies. In galaxies, there are like these nebular clouds in different phases, molecular phase or like with different temperatures. And we are trying to measure specific transitions of lines from these clouds. So for example, one of the lines, line intensity mapping experiments are after is the ionized carbon line, which has a rest frame frequency of 1900 and 1900 gigahertz. So if you measure, if your telescope can measure this in 420 to 650 gigahertz, what that means is you will measure this C2 line from redshift 2.5 to 3.6 due to the cosmological expansion. So just imagine I have a line intensity map at 500 gigahertz. What that will contain is this C2 line from this redshift. But is that the only thing that it will have? Actually, no. It will also have, for example, a CO molecular line with transitions from 5 to 4, which has a rest frame frequency of 576 gigahertz, but at from between redshift 0 to 0.4, it shows up in these kinds of frequency ranges, 420 to 650, which will definitely be in this map. Not just that, we have several other lines, C1 lines, and there are some other lines which I'm not even showing. So these are something called interlopers. Matt has a question, I think.
Yeah, I was just curious, what is the, bandwidth? Is that representative, like a few hundred gigahertz, or like how precisely do you in fact measure the lines? Not precisely enough to tell the difference, I guess.
You mean wait, difference between these interlopers?
Yeah, I guess there's no well, maybe my basic question is just what is the characteristic bandwidth?
So I think different experiments are targeting different based on the what kind of science they want to do. But 50 gigahertz is kind of typical for an X-claim like survey. The delta nu, but there are, for example, I think SpherX is going to go even smaller than that for some of the wavelengths. But nonetheless, that's not going to matter for lines and interlopers because this is a projected projected field in a sense that you can't really separate. So in this blob, for example, you will have C2 but also CO, and due to this delta nu which you have for your experiment, you just cannot separate them. Because what you get is like you are not really able to differentiate between them. And then, as I'll show you, like in the next slide, I think that there is also the continuum emission, which again adds more complications on top of this.
Okay.
All right. So yes. Right. Yeah. So as I said, so the interlopers are a big problem for this technique. Basically, you cannot differentiate between these lines, the target line and the other lines. And then when I say continuum emission for infrared wavelengths or infrared frequencies, I mean something like cosmic infrared background or even our Milky Way. They also emit exactly in these frequency ranges. And that's why they also dominate the contribution to such maps. So the message here is line intensity mapping technique is promising, but it has its own limitations. Right, so high redshift in years, coming to the first part of the talk, the high redshift in years. Now, when I say high redshift in years, I mean something greater than redshift 1.5 or 2. Now, below those redshifts, galaxy surveys are amazing. They trace the matter density field at these redshifts really well. But if you go to higher redshifts, doing galaxy surveys becomes a bit more expensive, as I had said before. So they are a bit unfeasible. But that's why we have this technique of line intensity mapping. But as I said, these continuum foregrounds or even interlopers make this technique a bit difficult to do cosmology. Now, what about So line intensity mapping, although promising, looks difficult. So that just says that constructing the matter density field at these redshifts, higher redshifts, greater than 1.5 or 2, is quite difficult. And if you go to even higher redshifts, basically reionization, cosmic dawn or dark ages, then these things become even more difficult than even at lower redshifts. So that's why we probably would like to have a new probe if we want to probe, if you want to look at these really high redshifts of the matter field at really high redshifts. I see a hand, Suvadeep.
Hi. So I was curious that won't you be able to cross-correlate with galaxy surface as low redshift to subtract out the contribution from interlopers?
Absolutely, yeah. So that's one of the things which has been suggested for to get rid of the interlopers, that you do this cross-correlation. But again, such techniques are not useful for Milky Way and CIB like galaxies, which have, for example, CIB has contributions from all the redshifts, right? From zero to even redshift six and higher. So you could potentially get rid of these interlopers. But that requires some things. You need galaxy surveys at these redshifts, these particular redshifts in that particular patch of the sky. That's one of the things. There is another thing, although there is something called interlopers, there is also something called extralopers, where you might have some line which comes from higher redshift than what you are trying to probe, and that falls in the same frequency band. And then you would need, in order to get rid of that, you would need probably a galaxy survey which goes at a redshift higher than this, and then it becomes difficult. Mm-hmm. So although it's possible, it is kind of difficult. But for sure, if you have some really nice galaxy surveys at low redshifts covering these precise these redshift bands, it is more or less possible to get rid of these interlopers. But CIB, no. Milky Way, no. And extralopers, difficult.
But for CIB, I can't use the CMB high frequency maps, let's say 353, to cross correlate with these maps and again some kind of subtraction out.
Good question. But then what happens if you look at the Planck 353 gigahertz map, for example? It will also have the C2 line, not just the CIB. It would have this line, right? Because the chemistry is the same. Yeah. So you will recover the same thing in a way. Basically, C2 times C2, C2 times CIB, CIB times CIB.
Yeah.
So that's a problem. There are some techniques proposed to get rid of these things, but it's still in a baby stage, let's say, right now. So tracing this matter field at high redshift becomes quite difficult. So we need a new probe if you want to look at this really high redshifts. And this is where, again, the weak lensing comes into the picture. So initially, I had talked about the weak lensing of the last scattering surface, but basically the CMB, but weak lensing can be of anything. It can be of a line intensity map at higher redshifts, or it can be of the galaxy surveys at lower redshift. And why am I talking about weak lensing again? Because as I have said to you before, weak lensing probes basically this matter distribution, projected mass density between its source plane and the observed plane. So for example, if you have a line intensity map at redshift 5, and if you observe its lensing, what you would, by reconstructing the 5 field from that observed lens map, you would be reconstructing the projected mass density from redshift 5 to redshift 0. That's why I'm kind of talking about weak lensing here. So weak lensing in itself is a tool to probe these high redshift projected maps. But what if I'm asking questions like this? What if I want to access the density field only for between redshift 1 and redshift 5? Or let's say, what if I want to access the density field only for redshift 5 and higher? Is that possible? Galaxy surveys would be really nice to have, nice solution for this, but they're too expensive and very limited at high redshifts. And line intensity mapping has its own problems. And just the only normal lensing won't work because it always gives this projected maps. So it does not differentiate between different redshifts. So this is where the second part of this talk enters, which is the something called lensing. So one might naively say, let's say you have lensing map of a line intensity. Let's say you have a line intensity map at redshift 5 of some line. You observe its lensing, you reconstruct the potential. Then let's say you have a galaxy map at redshift 1, you observe its lensing and reconstruct the density field between redshift 1 to 0. Why can't you just subtract them and then you will have this contribution between 1 to 5? But unfortunately, we cannot just subtract these curves, as is apparent from this plot, where if you do the subtraction, you still have a lot of contribution remaining from the low redshift universe. But there is a trick of this, something called nulling, for which we need to look at the shape of these curves. These shapes have a typical form. What that form is, basically, it is a second order polynomial in chi, where chi is the co-moving distance. And because they are this second order polynomial in co-moving distance, what we can do is we can actually combine these curves such that we can construct something called kappa null out of contribution of these three lensing kernels, such that this kappa null has zero contribution to the redshifts less than the lowest redshift, which is redshift 1. So you can construct this kappa null such that it is mathematically null for distances less than the smallest lensing kernel distance. This is great. Okay, so what this can answer one of the questions I was asking before: what if I want to probe only this redshift field? But then there was the other question I was asking: what if I want to probe redshift greater than 5 only? Then what you can do is, let's say you have line intensity map at redshift 5, then a line intensity map at redshift 6, and then you observe its lensing, and then you have the CMB lensing. You can combine these three lensing kernels such that the kappa null has zero contribution below redshift 5, and you observe only the kappa null response to only higher redshifts. Okay, so we wanted to see, mathematically this seems possible, but what could be the issues with this? Now you'll see I have used this word a lot now, limb lensing. So basically lensing of the line intensity maps. What about it? So limb lensing, we are not the first ones who are studying the lensing of the line intensity maps. This has been studied and it has been shown that it has its own issues. One of the issues is that the line intensity maps themselves are non-linear because of the gravitational evolution of the density field. And what it does is, when you reconstruct the lensing from these line intensity maps, this non-linearities in the map introduce some higher order biases when you reconstruct the lensing from these maps. So this is a problem, but it has been shown that this problem can be dealt with using something called bias-hardened estimators, for example, or there are some other techniques. Where Emmanuel Chan, in one of their papers, they showed that you can simply downweigh the modes which are contributing highly to these nonlinear effects to reduce these higher order biases. So there are techniques to get around this problem of nonlinearities of the line intensity map. But then we have continuum foregrounds like the CIB or Milky Way. How do we get rid of them? So again, what you can do is, when you do a 3D analysis, you can just discard the low k parallel modes of this of your data, which are primarily occupied by the CIB and the Milky Way, and then you can again go on with your business to do the limb lensing without worrying about the CIB or Milky Way like foregrounds. So it's possible to get around this problem as well. But then we realized nobody had actually talked about interlopers. And maybe we thought perhaps probably it's not a big deal for lensing, and that's why nobody has discussed it, but we wanted to check nonetheless. And what we wanted to check was, will the interlopers bias this CL kappa kappa signal? This is which is the signal we are after, the lensing power spectrum. What we found was this. So in this plot, this is the curve which we are trying to measure, CL kappa kappa, where this kappa field is being measured by a line intensity map of Lyman alpha at redshift 5. So this is just one of the examples. And line intensity map of Lyman alpha at redshift 5 has its own interlopers at lower redshifts. And so let's just focus on these two lines for now, the dashed line and dot dashed line. As you can see, these two lines are showing the interloper non-Gaussian biases to our measured signal. And as you can see, they are actually not negligible. And sometimes they are even of the same order of signal or even higher than the signal we are trying to measure. So this actually is an issue which was not observed before. And we realized if we are to use line intensity maps for lensing, we need a new estimator to get rid of this bias. Okay, so we came up with this idea of the limb pair lensing. As the name suggests, limb pair means we will now have two line intensity maps, a pair, and where we, instead of doing kappa XX or kappa YY, we'll have kappa XY, very similar to kappa TE, using T or E map, T and E map combination. So of course, there is a condition behind this choosing these pairs of lines. These two lines have to be at the same redshift if we need to construct an estimator out of them. But the important condition is this. This is the only condition for them, is their corresponding interlopers, should not overlap in redshift. For example, C2 line at redshift 5 has these, some of the interlopers are listed here, and they come up from these redshifts. And Lyman alpha line at that redshift 5 has these interlopers, for example. And the condition is that as long as these interlopers do not overlap in redshift, I think you should be fine to use this limb pair lensing estimator, kappa XY. So we were really happy. We thought we, using this, probably would get rid of the this non-Gaussian bias coming from the interlopers, because when you cross-correlate these things, these interlopers should factor out. This is what we found. So again, this is the signal we are trying to measure, the black curve. And I'm showing different pairs of estimators, but let's just focus on this particular line, the lowest line, which is basically the non-Gaussian bias coming from this line limb pair estimator, where X is Lyman alpha line and Y is the C2 line at redshift 5. So unfortunately, what we found was that XY is biased as well, this kappa XY, with something called secondary bispectrum biases. I'm not going to go into their details, but just to get the point across that even XY has some non-Gaussian bias, it's not zero. And now one might argue that this bias looks really small compared to the signal itself. So why worry, right? Maybe this is not a problem. But there is an issue. In the line intensity mapping is a very new arena, let's say. And so it comes with its own problems, where you have a lot of astrophysical uncertainty on the amplitude of individual lines. CL, when you try to calculate power spectra of C2 or Lyman alpha, different models by orders of magnitudes. So this curve can really go up and down significantly. So that's why we wanted something which completely gets rid of this bias. So, and that's when we had this idea. What if we do kappa XY, and then we realize that this has a completely zero non-Gaussian bias, irrespective of the astrophysical uncertainties you have in your line intensity maps. So this is great. So now finally we have a limb pair estimator, which can completely get rid of this non-Gaussian bias coming from the interlopers. Awesome. So once we have our estimator, can we detect this CL kappa XY kappa CND with what signal to noise? So this is a theoretical experiment which we proposed with sky fraction of 40%. And we showed that using this kind of signal can be detected to really high signal to noise, where different colors here are showing up to what LMAX you're probing the individual lines. And in the bracket, I'm showing what kind of approximate angular resolutions these LMAX show up as. Yes, Udup.
Yeah, So I have a question regarding when you are subtracting or cross-correlating XY with CMB. In the CMB, are you taking pure CMB or you are considering something like contributions from foregrounds as well? Like, awesome. Yeah,
good,
CIB.
Good question. Yeah. Good question. Yeah. So two things. First of all, what you can assume is you can only take CMB, the lensing where you are confident that foregrounds are not a problem. So let's say LMAX of 2000 or something, where foregrounds are still okay, they're under control. That's one of the solutions. The other solution is you can take kappa CMB, excuse me, from something like EB, kappa EB, where you only take polarized maps, where the foregrounds are not going to be correlated with this XY estimator. Because okay. XY is the intensity map which has this foreground, right? Okay. So these are the two solutions to get rid of this problem. But yeah, great question. All right. So with this kind of experiment, it seems like we will be able to probe this signal to really high signal to noise. Even if you reduce this 40% to 10% of the sky, the signal to noise is going to remain quite high. And these angular resolutions I'm mentioning here are actually not a problem because they are very much achievable even with the current experiments. There are some other issues though, like instrumental noise, which we will have to deal with. But nonetheless, we just show here that it is possible to detect this signal. But I had promised you that I had promised you some other signal, basically this kappa null times kappa CMB, only the high redshift part. Can we detect that? Yes, so this is the plot for this signal, where the solid lines are the signal to noise predictions for this kappa null times kappa CMB for the same experiment with 40% of the sky fraction. So it seems like even for kappa null times kappa CMB, for this experiment, it would still be detectable with this experiment. Again, if you decrease the 40% to 10%, the signal to noise for this particular case will come down from 20 to 10. So it will still be detectable. Angular resolution should not be an issue. And this just provides us with a nice probe of high redshift linears free of the interloper foreground biases. So that was our main plot and main result of this paper. And so the brief conclusions are non-Gaussian biases to the line intensity maps from interlopers are quite high, which was realized for the first time and quantified for the first time here. Our limb pair estimator completely fixes it, no matter what are the astrophysical uncertainties on the individual line intensity maps. And this technique of nulling allows us to access only the high redshift part of the universe. And if you combine, so there is work going on to get rid of these interlopers with different cleaning techniques. If you combine our estimator with such techniques, our detection SNR will further increase. And then we realize mathematically, there is this very interesting case of kappa XY times kappa ZW, where you have XY, ZW, four different lines. If they satisfy this condition that their interlopers don't overlap in redshift, it is mathematically possible to show that this estimator gets rid of the biases completely, interloper biases completely, and is a probe of high redshift linears independent of the CMB. So anyway, but this is like ultra futuristic, probably we'll never reach it. So we don't really discuss that in the paper. So if there are no questions and if I still have time, I would like to show a couple of results from a new paper I'm writing currently. Is that okay?
Well, we are a bit past time. Especially, why don't we take questions now? Awesome. Yeah. And then if people want to stay afterwards, they can stay to hear the new results as well. How does that sound?
Awesome. Yeah.
Okay, great. So first let's just give Abhi a round of applause.
Thank you.
Okay, and then let's take some questions. So Matt, I think, has his hand raised.
Okay, so let's say you could measure this and you get this lensing map at high redshift. What could you do with that? What kind of interesting science questions might you answer?
Good question. So one of the things is the application to reionization. You could basically, because in reionization we have this question, if the perturbations are like how much of the reionization perturbations are probed by the density perturbations. So you could possibly cross correlate Kapp and Hull, this high rate shift map with neutral hydrogen intensity maps. That's one of the applications. Then there is we know that at high redshifts, universe is slightly more linear than at lower redshifts. And that's why there's actually a very nice paper recently from some people from Berkeley, which show that at high redshifts, you can potentially constrain a lot of cosmological parameters much better than at low redshifts. For example, you have relativistic species, or you have basically ineffective or neutrino masses, or you have the FNL parameter, the primordial non-Gaussianity. That will be one of the applications, some of the applications for going to higher redshifts. So you are more linear, you're more confident in your perturbation theory up to some value of K or L. So doing such kind of science would be possible better than the low redshift.
Okay. And if we look at your cumulative SNR plots, I guess it's hard to conclude from just this plot, but you reconstruct modes around L of 100 best. Is that a fair statement, or like what scales are you actually sensitive to?
So maybe
just what physical scales at that time are you sensitive to? Maybe that's the thing I really want to know.
Right. It actually depends up to what Lmax you can go in your individual line intensity maps. It depends on this value of Lmax, but ideally, let's say for sure we would be able to reconstruct lensing very well for such cases below L of, let's say, low like larger angular scales. For sure we would be able to reconstruct very well. And then after that, it becomes a game of this instrument, dealing with the instrumental noise and how much deeper you can probe in this Lmax. So I cannot give a quantitative answer to that, but I can just say that larger angular scales are better constructed than the smaller angular scales, like is the case with the CMB lensing.
Okay, and so it's like BAO-ish scales, or if you had to guess, what physical scales?
quantitative answer, I think probably won't be possible for me. I don't think I can give a really quantitative answer.
Okay, thanks.
Sorry.
So I had like a more, I guess, like a simple kind of question. So how is your kappa null, different than, previous, work on using lensing tomography, to get the reconstruction of the mass at various different redshifts?
Right, yeah. Very, really good point. So lensing tomography is another solution to access different redshifts of the lensing maps, but for tomography you need a mass, another source of the large scale structure. In this case, we have lensing tomography has been shown to work with galaxies really well, but again with galaxies we cannot really go much higher than redshift of 1.5 or 2. So it is possible to do this lensing tomography, cross-correlating CMB lensing with galaxy surveys. But if you really want to go to such high redshifts, greater than 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 even, then you don't have galaxy redshift galaxy maps at such high redshifts, and then it becomes difficult.
Oh, no, no, sorry. Like, I didn't mean cross correlations with galaxies at low redshift. I just meant, you know, comparing lensing of sources at different redshifts and taking the differences of those lensing then to get, you know, like the mass distribution at various redshifts, right? You know,
right. So
Wayne and I talked about this like many, many years ago, right? And so I was just wondering, like, what's the difference of that compared to what you're saying here?
Right. So for example, you're saying I reconstruct lensing from something at redshift 5, then I take redshift 1 and I just subtract those two maps. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I guess kind of. I mean, well, right. So I measure lensing of sources at like redshift 5. I measure lensing of sources at redshift 4. Compare the two, you know, take the difference in some sense, and then use that to get like, you know, how much. I mean, right. I mean, yeah. I mean, there's things like this. You know, Wayne had talked about like, you know, years ago, and so I was just wondering. I mean, like, is that different than what you're saying, or is that similar? Or
so I'm not sure. What I need to read the paper from Wayne.
Okay.
But it just. Just if you just subtract the curves, you can see from this that it's not a good subtraction. You are still left with a lot of contribution from low redshifts, because the I'm not sure if I ever showed you what the lensing kernel looks like in mathematical
form. Yeah. No, I mean right. Yeah.
Probably not, because it's
just taking like the straight difference. You know, but if you, you know, use your knowledge of what like the kernels are as a function of the source redshift, you can, you can take appropriate combinations,
so
right? You know,
this, yeah.
Okay.
So
okay.
I'm not sure what when, I would need to read the paper, but then maybe probably it is what he has done. Probably he has utilized this second order polynomial thing.
Okay. Maybe. I don't know.
Because this technique has been shown for galaxy lensing from a group from Paris, Francis Bernardou and his collaborators. But nobody had thought of this for limb lensing or cross correlations with CMB. But thanks,
Yeah. Okay, were there further questions before we stop the recording? Going once, going twice. Okay, so great. So then, Craig, let's stop the recording. And let's thank Abhishek again for his great talk.
Thank you.